hello and thank you for downloading Wax Lyrical, the advertising and marketing podcast from Wax On and the Marketing Society. And I'm Mark Runicus.
And I'm Karen Harry. And in this episode, we're joined by two fascinating female founders who have created great products and built successful businesses. Amongst other things, we'll be talking about prejudice, faking it until you make it, and the secret to keeping close to your customers.
So I hope this comes out right. Hello, welcome. We're back Zooming after our episode a few weeks ago where we managed to get into the office. But because we've got two fascinating guests to keep us all COVID safe, we're back in our homes and Zooming again. And as I said, I hope this comes out right. But I'm really pleased to be the token man today, Karen, because we have two female guests. And in fact, the theme of today is talking about female founders. And what it's like to be a female entrepreneur. But first, I'd like to welcome Ellen Ruin-Prestes, founder of FitBakes, which is a range of delicious, I have to say, low-sugar, high-protein cakes. Hello, Ella. Welcome.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. And congratulations.
Me.
A few days ago, a new launch, yes, the carrot cake.
Yes, we launched, it's our autumn flavor, so something like a bit spicy, people have been asking, so yeah, it's launched in Friday, yeah.
And how's it going?
It's sold out.
Sold out, oh, well that's good.
We had to ask for an additional batch because it's sold out, yeah, so like actually everybody that is ordering that order yesterday and today, we already let them know that they are having like, they're going to have like 1 or 2 days delays in receiving the order because we have to make more.
I'd also like to welcome Racer de Haas. Racer is the co-founder of Double Dutch Drinks, which are award-winning premium mixers. And there are some really tasty sounding flavors. There's pomegranate and basil, cucumber and watermelon. And so welcome, Racer. Hello. And thank you for joining us.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's amazing to have you both here. And Mark, I agree. I'm very happy that you are the token man. Well, I thought we'd maybe start. We mentioned Double Dutch has some really delicious sounding products, and it would be great to learn a bit more about them. So, Racer, if you don't mind, can you tell us a bit more about your range of mixers and how you came about creating Double Dutch?
So we have a range of 10 premium and all-natural mixers and tonic waters. We do exciting flavors like cucumber, watermelon, pomegranate, and basil to do a little bit more than just a regular gin and tonic. But you can also drink them so with gins or vodkas or tequilas or just on their own. And I started Double Dutch together with my twin sister about 5 years ago here in London. We're Dutch twins, hence the name. And how we came into tonic making, our parents back in the Netherlands, where gin was originally invented, there are still lots of houses that have some kind of affiliation with distilling history. So the house where we grew up in with our parents, there was some kind of wholesale wine and spirit shop distilled in our garden. So because of that, we kind of grew up knowing all the local distilleries. We built a really big passion for good drinks. And then when we went to university, we basically just started making our own soft drinks for friends and families. We threw lots of parties on Wednesdays and Thursdays at our place, and we kind of always made the soft drinks for those. We asked our friends to bring a different bottle of vodka or tequila every week, and we just started experimenting with pear and mint and strawberry and lime and whatever. Some were really nice and some were not so nice. I studied a bachelor and master in finance, so I graduated. I started working in banking, and my sister a similar kind of finance course, but we absolutely both hated it. So we quit our jobs after 6 months and decided to moved to London to study a second master in tech entrepreneurship at UCL. And we basically came here and we saw, oh my God, the English, they drink even more than the Dutch. There was such a big gin and tonic hype here. So we asked our university here in London if we could devote our year about the whole gin and tonic hype and the fact that gins were massively booming. The tonics and mixers were kind of lagging behind in terms of flavor profiles, but also in variation and different brands. So they said, that's fine. We did a year of market research on what types of mixers consumers, bartenders, and retailers were really looking for. Graduated and got an award for best thesis of the year. And with that, our university said, if you want to start this company, we will fund your first production batch, we'll fund your first year, but you have to stay in the UK and do it here. So then we just thought, why not? We'll give it a try. And that was about 5 years ago. Then it took us about 6 months to really get our flavors right, to find our first production, and launched mid-2015 with our cucumber, watermelon, and pomegranate and basil.
Amazing. I love that story. There's a real passion for what you do, and also a real kind of spotting a real gap in the market. And I know, Ella, you have quite a similar story of having a real passion for something and following that. So tell us a bit more about Fit Bakes and how you came to the world of low sugar cakes.
The truth is that I'm a cakeaholic. So I would eat cake every day if I could. I'm this like carbs addicted person, like cake and bread, everything that you're supposed to be like, you know, eating portions, and I love it. So I had to find a way to be able to eat it more, basically. I mean, long story short, that was it. So, and I think in putting two things together, because I did grow up with a lot of like eating healthy and having like this correct, like natural sugar substitutes and natural avoiding soft drinks and drinking coconut water, this kind of stuff. So it was a cultural thing. And when I arrived in the UK, I saw that it is like the UK, I think because of the tradition of tea time, cake and tea time, it is literally cake land. You have like entire aisles and supermarket like only with cake. So it is, I think I was in heaven and hell at the same time, because then I had so much variety. It was so good. And then I went around, oh, okay, so let's look for the low sugar and high protein and reduced calories one. And there wasn't one. So I said, well, maybe I can make one. So yeah, that was like, making a very long story very short, that was it.
So I'm going to tackle the elephant in the room question, as I jokingly said, but I think this is a serious matter, the issue of what it's like being a female entrepreneur. And I think you've both got really valid points of view, because both of you aren't originally from the UK. So I think you do come at this, Raisa from Holland and Ella from Brazil. I'm sure you do come at this with a fresh pair of eyes. So Raisa, starting with you, I get the honest impression that the drinks business is quite a male-dominated sector. So did you encounter any prejudice as you were working through?
I think the drinks industry is super male-dominated. But I think there's definitely prejudices, and I think being young and female, definitely, I think the biggest challenge that we had and still have is that people don't take you as serious, especially in the beginning when you don't have a lot of credibility, when you don't have like lots of sales yet. Then I think it's really difficult to cut through that and to the fact that people really should be taking you serious. And if you probably were a male founder in a suit, it's probably slightly easier for the first step. But on the other hand, I do really think that it's all about how you look at these things, and kind of, I've always kind of looked at it from quite a positive side. And I think being female in a male-oriented industry, it does make you stand out more. And if you're doing sales, hopefully they will remember you a lot better. And I do think it's just how you approach these things, and if you look at it from a positive kind of way, it will be easier, and I think it will turn out to be more positive. And I think there is lots of, it's definitely slightly more difficult for female founders, but on the other hand as well, I think now there are so many mentorship programs and lots of kind of support programs for female founders. There's VC firms that only invest in female founded companies, and still, of course, female founders do get less funding on the investment side than male founders do, but it's kind of on us female founders to use that support and to really engage with that and support each other. And I think the good thing about female entrepreneurs, I think, is that we do help each other a lot more. And I think I think it's so much easier to pick up the phone. I think maybe the good thing about women is that it's slightly easier for us to ask for help, and be maybe because we are slightly more emotional, we don't really have like this idea of, oh my God, no, I need to do it on my own. And I'm a big alpha male. And I think it's on us really to make that change. And I do think there's lots of positivity and there is so much growth in it. And it's about how to approach it and approaching it from a slightly more positive side.
I want to go back to something you said. I think you said that female founders are less likely to get funding. That doesn't surprise me, but it terrifies me. Just tell me a bit more about that. Is that your experience or have you got evidence to support that?
I think there's like evidence that about only 20%, but correct me if I'm wrong, only 20% of all startups that get funded are female founded or have one female founder in their team. But that 20%, it might be something around it, it might be a little bit less or a little bit more, but at least like it's crazy. And I think it's for multiple reasons. But I do think that, it's really scary. And there are also less female founders than there are male founders. But I do think that that's definitely turning. And it's maybe a bad thing that now like the big VC firms and like corporates, they need to have this quota of also having X amount of female founded companies. And that's probably the wrong way to look at it, I think. But on the other hand, good for us. I mean, at least there's some change. And at least even if it's only about hitting a quota, if you get funding that way. So I do think that there's positive change, but there's still such a long road to go. So we just all kind of need to stick together and help each other out. And
I mean, on reflection, I'm sorry if it sounded like a stupid question, but yeah, I could not name one female angel investor. There are a couple on TV, and I'm sure they've been picked out for that reason. But amongst my circle of friends, I don't know any, so it doesn't surprise me. And Ella, I mean, you were nodding furiously when we were talking about that. Is your experience the same, that having a female leading a business means it can be more difficult to get funding?
I was part of a research from a university about this. And apparently, so he was doing a research on female founders and long interviews with each one to try to table exactly why, because apparently this evidence exists, why is there that female founders get less funding? And one of in his findings, which I thought was very interesting research, in his findings, one is definitely what Raisa said, is that there are less founders, there are women to start. So statistically speaking, it would be normal, there would be less. But there is his conclusion, and reading the research, not only his research, but other researches as well, I found fascinating and very interesting, is that a women's approach when presenting something to investors, they are more on the emotional side. So the women that get funding, they have that. This is conclusion where women, the women that get funding, they have very male dominant characteristics. They are very practical. They get there, they show the data, and they approach it like a man usually does. Obviously, there are practical women, there are men that are not practical. I'm just saying in general, right? So this would be a more male dominant characteristic. So what he said is, female, they have these male characteristics. Those are the ones that got funding. And he couldn't get even one exception. He got over, I think, 200 females actually founders interviewed. He said this cannot be a coincidence. So I think you have to know. And I did some mentorship with a couple of people in Norway, Oslo. And I had a female founder that she was presenting to me the pitch that she was going to present to the investors. And she said that and her whole pitch was about a chair or something, that it was better for people to sit more comfortable ergonomically speaking. It was amazing. But the whole story was about that she created the chair because her sister had cancer, and so the chair was more comfortable for that. And so I think that's an amazing story to sell, not to invest, because I'm not investing. I mean, I'm really sorry for her sister, but I'm not investing because she had cancer. So use that to sell, but don't use that to sell to investors. You have to know who you're selling to. So when you're selling to investors, come with numbers, show what they want to see, because what I want to see as I'm an investor is, okay, I agree with, let's say, with the principle of this. I want to support something that I think is going to do good for society, but I want to get my money back, because that's what I, it's not a charity, it's an investment. So that's what I think. That's what I think. I've seen a lot of women do wrong. So I think you have to know who you're pitching to.
Something I wanted to ask both of you, actually, and maybe we'll start with you, Ella, is what advice you have to female entrepreneurs or to women starting a business. It's something I'm really interested in as a woman in business. And Raisa, you spoke about having a more tight-knit community and female founders helping each other. And I love that idea that entrepreneurialism doesn't have to be cutthroat or ruthless to survive. And I wondered if you had any other advice for female founders, Ella.
I think instead of thinking, I don't really usually like to think like, it's a female founder, a male founder. I mean, we're founders in the story. And I think we have to each work with our best qualities. I'm a big fan of statistics. So like, let's say, let's play your odds. Go for what you're good. So if you're good on something, go and play that quality. And if you don't, there's something you really don't know what to do, hire somebody to do it. The best person, because so I think men have qualities and women have qualities, a lot of them that men have no idea how to deal with. So great, play on those, and actually that will definitely increase your chances of getting something right. I mean, like when we started, we played strongly on our qualities, and we went like we had a good tech background, so we went online. We knew nothing about manufacturing, so we outsourced production. So because, and people said, oh, but if you're outsourcing, you're giving your recipe to somebody else. I said, guys, look, I have 20 years of tech in my back. So it would, to know what I know, and I would, it took me 20 years to get here. So I know I'm proficient. I know that. Now, in order to be efficient in manufacturing, it would take me 20 years to get there. So I think it would be like naive and even like a bit like, let's say, not only naive, like it would be like, I don't even know how to say this in English, like a bit snobby of me to think that I can actually do something that I just learned. I mean, why would I be efficient in that? Just hire somebody. So, I mean, obviously watch the costs and everything. Our costs went dropped to 60% when we outsourced the production. So this is how bad I am in manufacturing. So play on your strengths always to anybody. That's what I would say.
Yeah, that's good advice. And I find it really interesting what you're talking about also in terms of getting the right person for the right job. And something that's interesting about your business, Raisa, is the right person for the job in terms of your partner is your twin sister. And I was interested to hear a bit more about how it is working with a sibling.
My overall tip would always be to, if you're just starting, I think it's so much easier to have a co-founder, or if you don't have a co-founder, like someone super close to you, whether it's a mentor or an advisor, or at least someone that you can bounce back ideas on and you're not completely alone. And I think the first months, years are so hard and so kind of draining, and you get so many no's, and it's kind of, ugh, like the downs are so down and then the ups are super up. And I think having a co-founder really makes it a lot more fun and a lot more, I mean, it all makes it kind of more lighter. And I think having a sibling and especially twin sister is that I think the good thing about working together is that you know each other 100% inside out. And I think we trust each other 100%. And I think the good thing is that it's quite easy and efficient in a way, because if we don't agree, we have a discussion. There's no tiptoeing. We just say how it is. Even if we have a fight, I don't care. 10 minutes later, we make up again. And I think that's quite easy. And I think having a co-founder that you're probably not super close with, or you're just friends with, it's slightly, you need to take it, I think, more in a British way, and very polite, and have a management meeting, and let's discuss how we can agree. And I think working together with your sibling is probably a more relaxed way. But on the other hand, I think the negatives about it is that social life and business life completely intertwine with each other. And I mean, on our Christmas dinners, we only talk about Double Edge, and if we don't talk about Double Edge, we talk about gin and tonics, and then tonics go back to Double Edge. So I think that's also, but as long as you, it's a cliche, but really love what you do and you're passionate about it, I mean, it's fine. And it could have, I mean, I think yeah, it's, I think that's totally fine and I don't mind that at all, but it is something to keep in mind, I think, when you start with a sibling.
Yeah, for sure. And I can imagine being able to be really honest with the people you work with must be a real benefit. And Ella, I was wondering if you looked for similar qualities in the type of team that you've built around you.
My co-founder is my husband. I don't really have to, like, I can't really fire him. No, but I think we were really, I mean, it's not an accident that, to be honest, like when I started the company, he wasn't even a part of the business. And then he started helping because he has completely, we are very complementary. I'm very tech finance, like numbers and stuff. And he is Mr. Relationship. He talks to everybody. He knows everybody. He is like the most networking oriented person I have ever seen. And also it does help because he's English. So it helps a lot because, you know, one local person, you know, I think it does help here. And so, yeah, so he took over this part of the business of sales and investment, investors relations. And he totally does a lot of things that I could never do again. So, yeah, so that was one thing. And then the other couple of people that we have around, yeah, we try to, like, again, we try to either outsource or hire somebody. I think hire somebody that knows more than you in that matter, but just don't hire somebody you can't fire. Like, yeah. Unless it's your husband or your sister.
Yeah, we were talking yesterday and I don't know. I had to have a little think about it. I don't know how complementary my husband and I would be to each other. I think maybe a bit of distance in our careers is a good thing in my case.
Oh, it's great. The one thing we did is we have offices on different floors. Because I can't look at each other like all the time. We have proper meetings. We have we actually sit down and we have like scheduled meetings. And out of that, we just try of course we're allowed to speak about it, but we try let's go to the pub. Okay, we're not going to be speaking about the packaging that didn't arrive or whatever, you know, because otherwise we did that in the beginning, but it's always ongoing. So it's a bit difficult.
It's very healthy. If he's listening, my husband, no, we're not going into business together. That is just not going to happen. In the last episode, we were talking about the fact that Karen was part of a team that actually launched a product in lockdown, which, without singing your praises, Karen, I think is an amazing kind of achievement. And I've spoken to other founders who say that it's really difficult deciding when to launch. You know, that's, is it ready? It has to be perfect. I'm only going to get one chance at this. Ella, how did you approach it when you got your first cake out of the door? Was it perfect?
Oh my god, it was so much not perfect. It was just like okay, this is good enough, let's see. It was perfect for what it was, the best I could do at the time, let's say, because I think we're always learning, we're always evolving, especially because I don't come from the industry. I'm specialized in eating cake, not in making cake. So for me, that was the best I could do at the time. And not only in the product itself actually was pretty good when we launched, but there were things that when you think about the market, in the food market, you learn after that are just as important as the taste for the clients, which is like your shelf life, your packaging, your distribution channels, so all this came afterwards. At first, we only had the great taste. That was it. And nutrition. Taste and nutrition. That was it. First. Then the price. Everything kept evolving and evolving. So our first cake was the first time we sold was made by myself in my little oven in my kitchen and sold through the website and put in little packaging that I bought on Amazon. So food graded Amazon packaging and with a sticker from Vistaprint with a logo made for £5 on Klaviyo on Fiverr. So that didn't look great. But I think even now, I mean, yesterday we ordered another batch of packaging to be printed of one that we are running out, and we changed it a little bit again. We're always improving. We get feedback from clients, we get a lot of feedback from social media. Also, some things might be might become more important than others. So, once you go along. So I think evolving is a, if you wait for it to be perfect, you're never going to launch. I think you have to, one, has to taste good. And second, it has to accomplish the laws and guidelines and everything, because food is very, very subject to that. So that's, there were the two things that we did in the, from, that we always have and we did from the beginning. But besides that, I mean, even if you spend a lot of money in the beginning and to get everything perfect and then produce, let's say, 100,000 packs for your products, you're going to realize you made a mistake afterwards, or not a mistake, but it could be better, maybe. So, and then you want to change it. So don't try perfection. It's never going to work.
Mm. Raisa, what's been your philosophy to launching? And you're constantly innovating. How do you do that as well?
I have a super similar thinking as Ella. I think you're completely right. When we launched our first batch of cucumber, watermelon, and pomegranate and basil, I mean, our labels were terrible. Our product was super okay, but we knew it wasn't 100% perfect. But we came out of university, we didn't have any savings. London is super expensive to live in. And we just had to launch and we needed to start selling. And I think that was kind of a good thing that we were forced to start actually selling to bars and restaurants, and we just knocked on doors. And I think the fact that we were quite desperate to get our first sale going kind of made us really passionate about it, and people started believing in us. But also, we launched with a product and we got real customer feedback from bartenders telling us, I really like the flavor, but you should add a little bit more sugar, or I think it would, if you add a little bit more acidity or whatever. We even had like one bar telling us after 2 months or something, and I think we had 15 customers signed up, so not big, but at least something going on. And they said, oh my God, I absolutely love the flavors, but your packaging, your labels on your bottles are so ugly that I need to find a way on how I can sell these without customers seeing the packaging. And then we thought, oh my God, this is the, like, we need to start rebranding now. And then we just asked everyone, like, what would you want to see in a label? And everyone said, like, oh, you need to incorporate your story more and to put that fact that it is 100% natural, and just obvious things that we didn't really thought about, but we just asked. And I think we still, like Ella, launch products that aren't probably 100% finished, and then we change along the way. And I think being a smaller company, people really forgive us for changing, and people want to be involved with the changes that you make. And I think waiting for perfection, it doesn't exist, but also it will take such a long time. And I think the most valuable feedback is to just get feedback from customers that are actually paying for your product, rather than doing consumer testing with friends and family. And it's always different than the people that are actually really buying from you.
So staying close to your customers, I guess, is the most important thing. Ella, am I right in assuming that carrot cake is a customer kind of idea originally? Is that where it came from?
Yeah, so we always encourage our customers on social media, like, to tell us what they would like, or what is missing. We changed our flavors quite a few times already for that, more in the beginning. Now I think we reached, like, let's say, a stable line. But what we did with carrot cake is we wanted to launch a new flavor, and we had two flavors in mind, which was carrot cake and raspberry white chocolate. And so we put in a poll in the social media and also through email marketing to our customers, and we asked them to vote. So what do you want? So they voted and they chose the carrot cakes. So I think, like Vanessa said, that you get your customers involved, you get their feedback, and it turns out actually carrot cake was actually people wanted it much more than some flavors that we already have. Like, we put carrot cake, like, to be compared with some that we already have. They say, like, oh no, I don't care about triple chocolate, just give me carrots. So we did a lot of different kinds of polls and stuff, and they chose it, and which is also a great tool for you to launch, because once they tell you what you want, then you send another email and another social media campaign saying, this is the winner. So everybody's like, okay, now my cake is coming. Oh, it's launched in a month, it's launched in 20 days, it's also, there is the, you know, so the build up for the launch and pre-ordering and everything. And then when it launches, people just feel it's their cake. because they chose it. So, and we literally sent like, you know, personalized emails saying like, oh, hi, Rasa, you chose it. We did it. Here's your cake. Have a carrot cake. So obviously you're going to buy it, you know, and hopefully you like it.
I want to talk about mentors, if we can, because often people say that we've got a whole world of mentors around us, that, you know, there's not necessarily one. But I'm going to force you to pick one. Raisa, if you could have had any mentor helping you along the way, who would they have been and why?
So I thought about this question, and I thought it was quite a difficult question because there are so many amazing mentors and actual mentors in your business, but also people that just give you inspiration from, like, podcasts or television or whatever, or books that you read from. So I thought about it and I couldn't pick one. So my first one was the Heineken family, because I think they're like to our company super close, and the one company that's the biggest, I think the biggest drinks business that's still family owned. And I think their four generations of families just making their brands bigger and bigger and bigger. And we're so lucky that Michelle and Charlene Heineken invested in Double Dutch. So they are our actual mentor. So I couldn't leave them out. So then definitely. Then I thought about, I think it would be amazing to have someone like a celebrity, for example, like Ryan Reynolds. He has his own gin brand.
So I've got him already. Brand. So you can't have him. He's all mine. He's gorgeous as well, isn't he?
And I think he's an awesome guy. I want to have a drink with him, a gin and tonic. And I think they probably know everyone, and the people he doesn't know, they want to hang out with Ryan, so he could introduce us to the whole world. And I think that would be amazing for distribution. And then I also thought about Richard Branson, because he's just so outside of the box. He is like this serial entrepreneur that did literally every industry in his life. He had a call-out which didn't work out, but I mean, he goes from airspace to drinks to whatever to So I think those three were kind of my ideal group of mentors.
I think that's perfect.
Also alive.
Yeah, the Heineken family, Ryan Reynolds and Richard Branson. Ella, can we delve into your world? Who would you have around you?
So I used to have one years ago that he used to be my idol, but now I don't like him anymore because I think he's actually a super villain. So in the 90s, in the late 90s, Raisa, that's how old I am. Yeah, don't look at me like that. In the late 90s, one of my idols was Elon Musk, which was nobody knew. Yeah. He was just, you know, an entrepreneur, nerd tech guy that was coming out and PayPal, this kind of stuff. But now he's just this crazy, I think he's actually a super villain because he has all the characteristics. He has the web name. He wants to dominate the world. He's launching satellites and putting people, like implanting people's heads, and he's going to turn everything on and we're all going to become robots or something. So that's my theory. So I don't want him anymore. I think he went too crazy. But there is one also that I always admired. I don't know if she's not well-known much. No, at all. She's British, funny enough. Her name is Ada Lovelace. And she was the daughter of Lord Byron, and she is the first coder in the world. And the first coder in the world is actually a woman. So she's a mathematician in the 19th century, and she's Countess Lovelace or some kind of. She became that afterwards. But think about how it was to be a woman in the early 1800s in being a mathematician and actually say, oh, you know that thing that you think about calling a computer? I think you can do algorithms. People must have looked at her and said, like, you're absolutely nuts. But she actually made herself heard. So I just think that's like one of the most fascinating things ever. Like, how do you, because it's not only what you do. I think what you do with your position and being a woman over there is at that time in life, you know, it must be like, all very, very, very funny.
Okay, we have one final question for both of you, hopefully a fun one. And we wanted to know, we ask everyone this, what your favorite TV ad was. So Raisa, do you have one?
I think like the Christmas Coca-Cola ones, because they are so recognizable and kind of something that every year there's a different version of it and something to look forward to. So definitely those. Oh,
yeah, they do mark the start of Christmas a little bit, don't they? And Ella, how about you?
Guinness, the Guinness ones. I love it. And most specifically, I fell in love with one that was once on about a few years ago. That's always the one I think my favorite commercial. The song comes in my mind. It was a Guinness one about this man in Congo that it was called the Guinness Suckers. So it was this man that worked really hard in like mines or this kind of stuff. And then at night, they just go out and they dress up with hats and colorful stuff and then go dancing and stuff because it's like, doesn't like play hard, but like, this is how you actually are. Like, you know, like a, so that commercial for me, I mean, Guinness commercials in general, they're just unbelievable. I'm a big fan, but that one for me, just like a, it did it. I saved it and everything. I have like links and stuff. I really like it.
You see my friends. With every brace and every cufflink, we say, I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul.
Well, look, I'm sorry to say that we've run out of time because I've so honestly enjoyed listening to you. I've learned so much from you. I hope that people who listen will take things away from it. If nothing else, that Ryan Reynolds would be one of the best mentors and they'll go away and learn more about Ada Lovelace as well. So, women, thank you so much. You've been an inspiration to our listeners, I am sure. I'm sure your businesses will go on to great success. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Bye-bye.